Please start the tape. The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
Let us pray. Gracious God, you come to us as the sower of the seed. We ask now that you would sprinkle us with the seed and with the water and the sun, that within us faith may continue to take root, to germinate, and to bud forth, that we may become the flowers of your creation, that we may become a part of the beauty to shine forth for all of the community, that in seeing us they may see a glimpse of you and what it means to be your people. Not for our glory, but for yours. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. My name is Doug Knick. I am a pastor at Eagle Lake Lutheran Church, which is on the north side of Willmar, which is in the state of Minnesota. As I alluded to yesterday, it's probably better to say, for those who are familiar with Minnesota, to say I'm only 6 miles from Green Lake Bible Camp. That will probably tell you more than Wilmer would. Our text for this morning, and the last in the series that I've done this past week, is from Matthew, the 13th chapter, the first 9 verses. We'll take a look at the text this morning, what it said then and what it says now to us, and then I will share a story with you from this text. Matthew 13, the first 9 verses. That same day Jesus went out of the house and sat beside the sea, and a great crowd gathered about him, so that he got into a boat and sat there, and the whole crowd stood on the beach. And he told them many things in parables, saying, a sower went out to sow, and as he sowed, some seed fell along the path, and the birds came and devoured them. Other seeds fell on rocky ground, where they did not have much soil, and immediately they sprang up, since they had no depth of soil. But when the sun rose, they were scorched, and since they had no root, they withered away. Other seeds fell upon thorns, and the thorns grew up and choked them. Other seeds fell on good soil and brought forth grain, some 100-fold, some 60, some 30. He who has ears, let him hear. The question that I propose that we begin with is asking you what you hear in this text, what jumps out at you, what catches your eye, catches your ear when you look and hear the text being read.
He who has ears, let him hear.
Okay, he who has ears, use them. Hear, make use of them, okay? Yes?
Poor farming practices.
Poor farming practices. How so?
You don't go around scattering seed, you know. You just prepare a plant bed and plant it, make it come up nicely.
Okay.
You don't just go scattering things, you know.
Okay. If, assuming your goal is in the end to have a nice looking field.
Have a crop.
Well, I have a place where I have my horses, and it looks like this. And over here is a lake, down here is my barn. And the hill is almost that steep. And it's real rocky. And I have these horses who like to eat, and they eat too much sometimes. So they keep this hill almost down to nothing at times. And I plant that hill with seed every spring and every fall. But I don't do it very orderly. I just take it and literally scatter it, hoping that some places along the way it does take root. So, and how we plant may have something to do with what we expect the harvest to be.
Right.
Yes?
I think that part of that indicates that how spoiled we are with this especially those of us in the Midwest, excellent farming conditions. There, there was so little soil that the arable soil was maybe small sections between the rocks, rather than a whole vast expanse with maybe an occasional rock or something of that sort.
Okay.
Maybe kind of like trying to plant on some of these hillsides.
Yeah.
Mountainsides.
Yeah. Certainly for us, I would have to agree that for us, this is poor farming practice, definitely.
Yeah.
Okay, some other things that jump out, or that you note from this text, or here.
Everything starts as a seed.
Starts as a seed. Okay.
The characteristic of seed is growth, and once the seed is planted, it has a growth of its own.
Okay, that seed has a life of its own and it grows. Okay.
But not all the seeds have the equal chance at soils.
Okay. Yes.
What jumps out at me is a warning against providing superfluous, quick and easy ministry.
Okay.
It's a lot easier.
Much easier. Much easier. For me, there's always, following up on that, there's always something enticing about interim ministry. Because you can go in and do it quick and quick get out. You can dump your load, make everyone feel uncomfortable, and do some cutting and cleaning up, and then leave. It's more difficult to stay in for the longer haul.
It doesn't give them a chance to put out a petition to get rid of that guy.
Or a colleague of mine who I admire and love dearly says, hey, I have no roots here. They want me to leave. I can be gone in 12 hours. So doesn't have the mentality that he's going to be there for long either. So.
On the other hand, it can be a very, very, very difficult job. My home church just went through that type of a situation where there was a pastor who lingered. He became sickly. He'd always had some problems where he and the congregation never really met. And the situation grew worse and worse. There were perhaps even some mental problems involved. There were Sundays when he was not there and no one even knew where he was. And then, from what I've heard, there is a new pastor now, but what I hear about, and the interim pastor's name, John Olson, which almost sounds like a generic pastor in a way. I have no knowledge of this person, but they have nothing but praise for him. The job that he was able to do to come in and heal the wounds, bring back the people who had decided that they needed to go to other churches in order to be ministered unto, and to prepare them for the coming of another pastor who would be a different, completely different type of personality. And that pastor's been there for almost a year now. So they've had long enough to find out whether they were being hoodwinked or not, and they're very happy, but not just praise for the present pastor, but over and over again I heard that John Olson did such a good job for us. So, yeah.
I'm not trying to make light of the interim. In fact, I'm just the opposite. I think that the church has to begin to recognize the importance of interim ministry and develop it, rather than sticking whoever doesn't have a call at the present time in the interim, or using just retired pastors to fill that vacancy. Because it is an art, a gift, to be able to do interim ministry and do it well. What else from this text jumps off, or you note?
When I think about it, it's a parable that's particularly fitting for the agricultural community of that day.
Okay.
I'm kind of wondering what it would be today. obviously with a relatively small number of people that have any contact with the soil for whom this type, you know, sowing, broadcasting seed by hand, that type of thing, nobody, hardly anybody does that except when they're reseeding a little plot on their lawn.
Mm-hmm.
It really has relatively little contact with our practices today.
Yeah, okay.
Well, the sowing seed by hand doesn't bother me, but it makes me wonder if this was typical of the practices of the time to not differentiate between the different types of soil.
Does anyone know?
Well, that's what I was alluding to, that there's so little really good right. soil there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Doesn't it, when the same thing comes up in Mark, doesn't it mention it falls on the pathway where it's hard?
Yes.
And much more specific, you can see that if, even as you go to plant the fields, that you're, even today, some of that spills over, you know, onto other areas besides what it, where it's intended. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes.
I've always really liked this passage because it illustrates, I think, in a, to me anyway, in a very visual way, what it's like to try to grow as a Christian, the struggles that you have, and the things that you see in people being choked mm-hmm. by different things,
mm-hmm. and
starting out with a very shaky foundation. Then the continual struggle. You know, just because you start in a good soil doesn't mean that you remain there. Thistles won't come in some later time. So it's, I just consider it a really, really wonderful parable illustrating what it's like to live.
Okay. Anyone else? I want to offer one other item here. The setting, and somewhat moves us into the next one, the text and the context, what comes before, what comes after. But I want to offer, before we leave the first part, note what Jesus does and note what the crowd does. Jesus goes into the boat and sits. The crowd stands. The image is that of what they were familiar with. The hearers of the day of this or the readers when Mark compiled the gospel would have identified that is what happens when the rabbi, the teacher, begins to do his thing. In the synagogue, they sat while everyone else stood. So the scene created here by Matthew is, it is an occasion of teaching, instruction. The one with authority who will teach is now seated, and the rest are standing, which is opposite of what we do, right? Everybody sits and the one stands. The opposite notion here, but this opposite scene, but same notion. Jesus is standing, and I want to offer up, as we move along, the importance of the crowd here, okay? Mm-hmm. I want to keep that. So we don't lose that. What's the text in the context? In other words, what comes before, what comes after? What comes before? To help us look at that, I think we need to go back to chapter 11, verse 1, to get the context. Someone want to read the first two verses? Chapter 11.
And when Jesus had finished instructing his 12 disciples, he went on from there to teach and preach in their cities. Now when John heard in prison about the deeds of the Christ, he sent word by the disciples and said to him, are you he who is to come, or shall we look for another?
That's fine, thank you. So the scene is set in chapter 11 that Jesus is now picking up, continuing on the ministry of teaching and preaching. And in fact, if you follow through chapter 11 and chapter 12, it doesn't ever give you a distinct ending of that day. It just goes on and on and on and is compiled. At that time, at that time, at that time, it just goes over and over with different people interacting with him. First, there's healing of some demons, casting out demons and healing dumb and a withered man and a dumb and blind man. Then the Pharisees and Sadducees come and interact with him. They want a sign. Jesus won't give them a sign. He says he'll have the sign of Jonah. And then chapter 13, the first verse, that same day Jesus went out of the house and sat beside the sea. The guy's got to be exhausted, if indeed this is all one day. And he's exhausted in that, get me away from the crowd. Which, what's the text for Sunday? For those of you who might have been a part of the text or looked ahead for the text study on Thursday or read the text for Sunday, what's the text for Sunday? Anyone remember? Jesus has commissioned, last week we read the commission of the 12 to go out. Now they come back. We skipped the story in between about the beheading of John the Baptist. In Mark, they come back in chapter 6. And they're all excited and they want to just unload everything that's happened. And what does Jesus say? Let us go away to a lonely place and rest. What happens when they get there to rest? The crowd appears. What does Jesus do? Has compassion on the crowd. Like a shepherd, like sheep without a shepherd, Jesus has compassion on them. A similar setting here in some respects, that Jesus wants to take a breath of air. But who appears? And what does he do? He picks up the thing he's come to do. He begins to teach them. He teaches them in parables. What follows? That's what comes before. What follows? Verses that always make me nervous, because I have not quite figured out how to preach these verses that follow. If someone would want to read verses 10 through, go 10 through 17. If someone would read that. Must be too cold in here. You'll get warm if you read. Okay. Then the disciples came. Okay, Jesus has spoken with the crowd here. Then the disciples came and said to him, "Why do you speak to them in parables?" And he answered them, "To you it has been given to know the secrets of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been given. For to him who has will more be given, and he will have abundance. But from him who has not, even what he has will be taken away. And this is why I speak to them in parables, because seeing they do not see, and hearing they do not hear, nor do they understand. With them indeed is fulfilled the prophecy of Isaiah, which says, 'You shall indeed hear, but never understand, and you shall indeed see, but never perceive. For this people's heart has grown dull, and their ears are heavy of hearing, and their eyes have closed, lest they should perceive with their ears, with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and turn to me to heal them. But blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear. Truly I say to you, many prophets and righteous men long to see what you see, and did not see it, and to hear what you hear, and did not hear it.'" That has an important part in relationship to this parable. It follows very closely with the parable of hearing, and not just hearing, but understanding what one hears. Having the ears to hear, having the eyes to see and seeing. Or as Michael has said, maybe it's time to sniff around for a while. Smell and discern what one smells. Some thoughts on that?
Well, the uncomfortable thought there is that makes the disciples elite
little group.
Okay.
But which they were, of course, and chosen for the fact that they would be open to what they would see and hear, whereas many or most others would not be.
Okay. And what did they hear? Now we're moving into the community one. I want to move us along. What did they hear?
The crowd or the disciples?
The disciples for now. What did they hear?
Well, the fulfillment of the promise, the fulfillment of the covenant, which Jesus says that many had longed for that day, but they've grown weary of waiting and basically gone to sleep. They're no longer really alert or awake for it.
Okay.
I don't think that I know for sure what they heard. I think that I have glimpses of things that they heard. Peter, for example, I think. I always wondered what it would be like to have been in that situation where all of a sudden Peter realized that this was the Son of God. But it's hard for me to see it in that context because it wasn't that way with me. I can guess some of the things that they heard, but I'm not sure I understand all.
Okay. A better illustration might be the centurion who is standing beneath the cross as Jesus dies and says, "Oh my God, that was the Son of Man." Peter seems to be more, I think what we often are is a gradual understanding and not denial and back and forth. Yes?
I don't think the disciples heard anything more than the crowd. They were completely in the dark.
Okay.
And they had to continually ask him, and even when he explained it, they come back almost in the next sentence and be completely mystified as to what he was talking about. If you look at John, there's no requirement to be a Christian, that's to believe. That's all it takes.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, if you look at Peter, he's a perfect example of a spiritually immature person. Somebody who's walked 3 years with Christ, he has to be hit on the head 3 times before he can even grasp that, you know, that this is Christ. Here's a guy that walked on the water. You know, he had enough faith for that. Yet he was completely unclear until, even after the 3 days, he comes barreling down, runs to the tomb, he looks around, he sees all the evidence. He doesn't have a clue as to what's going on. And then John says, then John understood as he crept in after Peter. Even later, Christ appeared 2 times, and then he appears for the 3rd time. Well, Peter's taking this group out to go back to his profession of fishing. Here's Peter after the resurrection. He now knows what really has happened. He's going to go back to fishing. And Christ asked him 3 times, "You want those fish?" Here's a miraculous, this is a peak of professional achievement. 153 fish you got in your net. Do you want these or do you want to follow me? And then we look at the difference between that person at the end of that time and the person who wrote 1 and 2 Peter. I think there's 2 processes here. One of them is believing. The other one is growing and spiritual maturity. For those who have belief, then the parables make sense. Slowly, over time, you grow spiritually. For those who do not yet believe, the rest of what's said doesn't make an ounce of sense. And in many regards, Peter and the disciples are very much along with the crowd.
Okay, I think, just as a comment, I think one needs to be careful in blending a caricature of the disciples from all 4 Gospels, because each have a different presentation of the Gospels. That's very true, your presentation of for Mark. Mark, the disciples are these bumbling idiots who, you know, just don't catch on. If we were to carry on with Mark 6, we would see after the feeding of the 5,000, they get in the boat, and the first thing you say is, "Oh my gosh, we don't have bread with us. What are we going to do?" I mean, how
it's humorous because you got Jesus. Well, I mean, what more do you need? I mean, just fed 5,000 people. I mean, how can you worry about you don't have enough bread? That's very true for Mark. For Matthew, more of what's at stake for the disciples is they do recognize Jesus as the Christ, but they don't know what that means yet. They know it. They want to get out there with, so anxious to get out there and spread it. They don't know quite what they're going to spread yet, other than Jesus is Christ. But what are the implications of that? They're not quite sure yet. So there is a sense in Matthew, they know it, but they don't know the implications of it. But thank that it, yes. I think you're right. The disciples are part of the crowd, the crowd's part of the disciples as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Is it kind of, you know, the disciples not knowing what's in front of them exactly, is this kind of telling them, you know, they're going to be sent out sowing seeds, and, you know, some of them will get planted, but nothing's going to happen. You know, you get discouraged, things start to grow and die off, but then there will be seeds that grow, and then they will produce, you know, some 60, some 30, some 100-fold. So they don't get discouraged, you know, things will work.
Possibly. Possibly, yeah.
I don't know. I think it can go either way. That's the tension. I guess one of the things that came to mind in that particular area is, you know, the conversation I had with somebody recently. Quickly go through it. He had three sons, and two of them do well professionally. I'm talking about our day and age now. So that's very satisfying. And the third son is a wanderer, can't really decide what he wants to do, and he doesn't, you know, he hasn't fit in. And you think about how you think about those three sons. And the only thing I could say to this person was, who did Christ visit when he came here? Who was he with? He was with the prostitutes, the tax collectors. And there's that tension I always find myself in. I'm a scientist. I have a lot compared to almost most people in the world. Would in fact Christ visit me at all if he came?
Yes.
He visited Zacchaeus, and you name the things that Zacchaeus didn't have. There aren't many things he didn't have in this world. But he had one thing he needed. That's what Christ healed. So I don't think anybody with things should worry about that.
Right.
So
I want to propose here that and to feed off on both what Michael has done this past week as well as what Hosea has done, is to change roles here, reassign the cast of characters here for a moment. And I want to propose that when we do a text like this, we do the ecclesiastical Darwinism. That we immediately turn it into an individualized text. And we forget the crowd who gathers, and we move away immediately to think, to identify, well, who is the path, who is the rock, who are the thorns, and who is the good soil. I want to propose this morning that we look at it from a community of koinonia here, and that it is important that we recognize the crowd here and the disciples as possibly all one standing there together, and that a community is made up of the path, the rocks, the thorns, and the good soil. And it's not the individual who produces the 100-fold, the 60-fold, the 30-fold, but the community. Which goes back along to what was said at the beginning, that you don't have a nice little plot here of good soil. which runs along a pathway, and then you get over to a rocky area, and then you have in between a nice place where only the thorns grow. I had the opportunity to work on a farm that was some of the best land, not the best, but some of the best in the state of Minnesota. I spent numerous hours with my hoe walking because that soil which grew corn well also was wonderful land to grow the weeds. That there was a sense that it was together. It was a community, and that all of them existed together. And as someone stated wonderfully in the first hour, because there was only six of us here, self, I only hear with my ears. The necessity at that point of the community and of that koinonia, who participates back and forth together, who hosts and who is guests, at times hosts for the path, and at times guests of the good soil. Respond to that for a moment. Because I think usually we interpret, as my confirmation kids in their second year of study, they have to write a sermon on this text. I use the text from Mark because we studied the book of Mark throughout our second year of confirmation. They have to write a sermon on this text, and inevitably every single one ends the sermon with the question, and who are you? The path, the good soil, the rock, the thorns, who are you? As if somehow I'm going to become something other on my own free will, choice. I don't want to get into that again. Excuse me, wrong word. But what about if we see this in a different light? Maybe it's not different. Maybe it's only me. Maybe you've all seen it that way before, and maybe it's just hit me differently. Respond to that.
Sure, I understand what you're implying as far as the affecting the community, a community reaction. Is this what you're talking about, a group reaction to it?
No, I think I can respond to that.
Okay.
I think that one of the things that mm-hmm. happened to me as a person, and I was never around a family as such. That is, my family never had relatives or anything like that. So very early on, my wife and I realized that we needed koinonia, we needed a community. Because of just what you said, I learned that I didn't really know who I was entirely without the community. And there was a nurturing back and forth, just as it happened just here, just a second ago. And that has always been then a part of my existence and going into a new community, finding koinonia, finding that those people who could enable me to grow to just almost exactly in the way that you were talking about, I think. And what I realized, that the biggest difference between what I had learned earlier as a relationship, my relationship being vertical, me and God, is that it wasn't that. In fact, my growth really came from community and just kind of almost reversed what I thought about Christianity in a sense. And so I think that's part of what you're saying.
Yeah. I really like the way that you turned this around, because I agree that an individual is planted actually in many kinds of soil in his community, one of which is his church. And the community that I'm put in, I'm also a scientist, and the cares and worries of that would easily choke out any faith that I had. And it's up to my church also to provide, as a community, a soil from which I can grow. And one of the criticisms that I've had of our particular church in the past has been that it hasn't provided that soil. It's a growing church which provided no kind of ministry. It didn't certainly minister to my needs as to a fertile soil. And I think that it is our job as a church to provide that soil so that there can be one place where I'm planted that I indeed can grow.
Okay. The follow-up, verse 11, when the disciples came to Jesus and said, "Why do you speak to them in parables?" I always wanted to interpret that as saying, why don't you just make it clearer? You know, just spill it out for them. I mean, you're the Christ, you know, get on with it.
Get to the point.
But if we understand the way the rabbis taught, they did teach in parables. So in the sense, the disciples, I'm wondering if they're not offended that Jesus, the rabbi, the Christ, has used that with this crowd who they would recognize as the path and the thorns and the rocky soil. He's included them in this community. When they want to be the, you know, when they want to be set up, Jesus has flipped it. As Jose, he would say, made the powerless here, and that he's turned it and said, oh, but your parameters on who we are much bigger than just the 12 of us. They include this community now. And the seed is cast recklessly in some sense, but it's not reckless, upon them all. So that we have to push out the walls of the community to include who we would want to keep out. So their question is one of anger with Jesus, not for teaching in parables, as a sense, make it clearer, but as a sense, you're doing what we're only supposed to hear now to all these other people with the ears.
The next verses don't seem to bear that out.
Okay.
Because he's explaining to you get to know the secrets. They haven't. So it's being hidden from them through the parable.
I mean, except he who has ears, let him hear. And that's spoken to the crowd.
Well, yeah. Wait a minute. There's a subtle in the thing that you said. How do you hear? I think that's incredibly important. I mean, the parable can be hidden because they don't hear. And the question is how do you develop the capability of hearing? Part of that, I think, goes right back to what you said. It's pretty hard to hear if you don't have a community to listen to. If you're just listening to yourself.
Go ahead, Michael.
I think one of the things that the parable pushes toward having us grapple with and confront is not so much how do we hear, but to whom are we listening? I mean, that's, again, if you have ears to hear, in that sense, we're all hearing. We're hearing all sorts of things. I mean, everybody's going around preaching all sorts, you know, eat the right foods in your life, you know, follow this program and your sex life will be better, and, you know, everybody's telling us to do all sorts. We hear all sorts of, you know, go to any bookstore. You can find 50 different ways to put your life together, and some of them are queer. You can be the ministry manager and all this great stuff. But again, the question here is, to whom are you listening? What are you hearing? And that, again, Jesus too preaches this word, and to some it might seem secret and hidden and confusing, because when it's mixed up with all these other things we're hearing, again, the first response might be that of kind of scratching our heads and saying, now what's going on here? I'm a bit confused because this sounds different from other things that I'm hearing. and then again that penchant to clarify. The other thing that I think is important here with that sense of community is, it fits in with what Gertrude said this morning at Matins and the notion of extravagance. The yields here are extravagant, 30, 60, 100 fold. At least someone like a biblical scholar like Joachim Jeremias, who tries to again figure out precisely what the context of first century Palestine might be, says that a farmer at that time sowing without fertilizers and all of that kind of stuff could expect 7 to 10 times a yield of what they had planted. So if you plant a bushel, you'd get 7 or 10 bushels. That'd be a wonderful crop and you'd be happy. Here you're sowing, let's say, a bushel, and what will come back? 30 bushels, 60 bushels, 100 bushels. I mean, that's just extravagant. That's unbelievable. And so it, as well in this parable, one can say, well, look at all the waste, right, on the rocks, in the weeds. It's all for naught. And yet, surprisingly as well, there is such an abundant yield that is beyond any expectation we might have. And that, again, causes us, I think, to scratch our heads and say, what's going on here?
Yes.
Oh, to speak in parables was just his way to get across to the crowd, I think. So they could understand what he was trying to say. He had to bring it down to everyday understanding of the people. If he would have talked to a bunch of Pharisees, he would have spoken differently, probably. Yeah. But to the people, to go around and scatter the seeds. All right, if he was a today, if he would walking today and talk about the same thing, he would say, okay, I want to renovate this rangeland here, and so we use some aerial seeding, okay? And we go out and we scatter it over 15 miles, and pretty soon we grow. And the same thing will happen. The seeds will fall anywhere, but you will establish a new good range, you know. You got to be with the times.
Okay.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah. Well, to me, it's a great gift that he spoke in parables, because as an artist, you know, a parable is an art form, and you see different things each time. You're in a different space and a different point. You know, you talked about the youth looking at it in terms of development. What are you going to be at that point in their lives? That's what they're focusing on. And had he spoken in direct terms and not used parables, it would have been quick. And it would have been something they would have grasped immediately, and that's not what he wants. And it's something that we do have to sift and figure out, and it'll, if we figure it out tomorrow, it'll be something different than if we figure it out today. And that's the value of it.
Okay. I go back to something that you said. Probably having a little bit different dimension. Because when you, if you're going to listen to someone, what is it that brings you back to really hear what that person says? I mean, what is it that somehow makes that person someone you want to listen to, someone you want to hear? I think that's part of what Michael is getting at, but it's a little bit different. I think that there's an element of action involved in that, a little bit of looking at what that person really is, what he does, what he's about.
Some other thoughts that you might have on this text. Certainly one cannot lose, as Michael lifted up for us, he cannot lose the notion of the sower here and that which is being, the seed that is being cast. Can never lose sight of that. The story this morning is from this text, as the other stories have been. The story is entitled, What on Earth? What on Earth? What on the face of the earth is the sower in the parable attempting to accomplish? What kind of farmer goes out and throws the seed about so recklessly? Seed that any farmer will tell you is not cheap. Seed that carries with it a price. What sower sows the seed on a pathway, fully aware that if the birds and the rodents don't devour it, surely the seed will be trampled underfoot? Why throw the seed among the patches of rock, knowing that the soil is little and cannot support the plant for harvest? Or again, what can the sower be thinking when the seed is cast into the weeds, where it will only be choked out? What on earth is the sower doing or thinking? This simply is not good use of the seed, something we would call poor stewardship. Luther Mundel lived a stone's throw north of the parsonage, a lifelong member of the church, a church which stood less than a mile from his house, but a church he had not attended since I had arrived. Some of the natives said Luther had not been in church since 1957, the same year his wife died. Some even said it was the day of the funeral which marked his last entrance into the church. But Luther paid his yearly dues to the church, and so no one bothered him. I always thought that was the way Luther wanted it too. I got that feeling from the way he parked his 67 Chevy and 72 Ford pickup. The yard road from the tarway to Luther's place was roughly a mile in length, but very seldom did either of his vehicles reach the farm place. They usually were parked sideways like a barricade to block the end of the road. I took this as a sign that Luther did not want any uninvited guests bothering him. Some say that every winter Luther went south for a month or two, but it was impossible to tell, for the farm place looked the same way year round, lifeless, cold, abandoned. This which I tell you about Luther Mundel, I tell you not from having met him, but only from observation. It would be some time before I would actually meet old Luther Mundel. Luther farmed 280 acres with two small tractors, neither of which could pull anything more than a three-bottom plow. And his machinery was old and worn, and it all looked the same. Red. Not international red, not farm all red, just rusted red. But the age of machinery and the color never stopped Luther from being the first person in the field every spring. As I drove north past his fields to reach the tarway, I would always wave as a gesture of friendliness, but Luther never responded. He just farmed the earth. I knew I should visit old Luther Mundel, if not as his pastor, at least to be neighborly. But I never knew what to expect. I was not sure what I might be getting myself into. If this man had not been in church since 1957, the same year his wife passed away, who knew the amount of anger that might have been built up within inside him? I told myself I should call on him, words spoken early in the morning, yet by afternoon I had always been able to set it behind some other pressing issues. For those unaware of a pastor's schedule, Ash Wednesday is a very busy day. It is not only the beginning of the Lenten season and therefore the first in a series of sermons to be prepared, a sermon which needs to lay out the theme yet not give away all the details. It is also a day filled with numerous errands, none by themselves too consuming, but put together they can be. It was in the midst of preparation that the phone in the basement office of the parsonage rang. It was Luther Mundel's sister, Esther, from the neighboring town. She told me, without taking a breath of air, that Luther rode the bus to Minneapolis yesterday to the Veterans Hospital and that he was not going to be returning. They were keeping him. She didn't know any other details than that it had to be serious or Luther would not have agreed to stay. I reassured Esther that we would remember Luther in prayer that evening during the Ash Wednesday service, and that tomorrow I would go to the cities to see him. By 6 a.m. Thursday morning, I was heading eastward. I knew that it would take several hours to get there, and I did not want to spend the whole day in the cities, for you see, I had yet to start Sunday sermon. I found the Veterans Hospital quite easily, and without too much trouble located Luther's room, or I should say, ward. The old Vets Hospital, filled with men standing, smoking in the lounges, was not what you would call an attractive place. The building was literally falling apart. Cracks in the walls ran from the ceiling to the floor, paint peeling in the corners, and not a single hallway level anywhere. And no patients had a private room. To be in a room of three was considered private. Even the hallways held beds. And there was that smell. Not something you could describe, but something that made you sick. Luther's room was no different. There, in a square room, were six beds, each occupied by a male body, but not every body was complete. Three of the men were missing either an arm, a leg, or both. One coughed uncontrollably, another slept, and one lay lifeless. Since I had never met Luther, I went by the bed number given to me at the desk. Bed number 3. That was the lifeless body. As I approached the bedside, I was surprised by the man's features. Luther, at age 78, had not yet begun to lose his body tone. The skin of his face was tight and his hands were firm and hard. His body, though lifeless, resembled that of a rock. As I greeted Luther, I told him who I was. There was no response. His eyes did not even move, but remained fixed on a spot somewhere out in the hall. A hot flash spread through my body. Perhaps I had the wrong bed. I searched for some confirmation that indeed this was Luther Mundahl, the man who never came to church, the man who parked his Chevy and Ford at the end of his road, the man who did not wave. My eyes rolled down his arm, which lay beside his body. There on his wrist, just above his massive hand, I read the yellow plastic band, Luther Mundahl, bed number 3. Yep, I had the right bed, and so I tried again. Still, no response. I attempted to make conversation, but it was nothing more than a monologue. I could have been speaking to any of the other 5 men in the room and had just as much success. Frustrated and growing angry, I decided it was fruitless to stay much longer. I asked Luther if we should have a word of prayer together. "It's your time," he responded. The lifeless body spoke. It did not move, but it spoke. And since he spoke and did not say no, I took that to mean yes. And so I prayed. And boy, did I pray. The prayer was nothing short of saintly, heavenly, majestic. Even the angels in heaven sat up and took note. With old Luther Mundahl just laid there, eyes open, hands unfolded, staring out into the hallway. As I rose to say goodbye, I reached out to shake his hand, but quickly brought it back to my side so as not to look foolish. Luther was not going to take my hand in his. As I reached the doorway, now directly in line with his eyes, I stopped, turned, and I said, "I'll be back next week." As I rode the rumbling elevator down from the 6th floor, I wondered, what on earth is wrong with this guy? Every week for the next 6 weeks, I drove the 6-hour round trip to visit old Luther Mundahl. And every week, the visit went the same. I read to him the text for the next Sunday. I prayed, and then I would offer him communion, and he would say, "No." And so then I would share some thoughts on what I would preach on Sunday, and he would not respond, but like a rock, he laid there. I'm not sure why I went week after week to visit Luther. probably nothing more than trying to ease my guilt for not having visited him sooner. One thing I knew for sure, it was not for the conversation. The day broke, with the sun hidden by low clouds, thick and heavy. They appeared to be uncertain whether they would drop snow or rain, but in either case, determined not to let the sun be seen. This gray, gloomy day was the first Sunday after Easter, and the worship service proceeded as expected. The sermon had been delivered, and the congregation, with hymnal in hand, sang, "Now the green blade rises." Each verse of the hymn ends with the same refrain, "Love is come again like wheat arising green." It was as the congregation sang the refrain a second time that the phone downstairs began to ring. An usher heard the noise and departed, only to return carrying a note he delivered to me. It read, "Luther Mundahl is dying. He has asked for communion." Needless to say, I wasted no time in ending the service, and beneath the dark clouds rushed eastward. As I drove, I wondered to myself, why? Or rather, what on earth has moved this man to ask for communion? And why for me? There were chaplains at the hospital who could easily have served him the sacrament. But he had someone call for me. The three-hour trip was made in 2 hours and 15 minutes, and before I even reached the elevator doors, I told myself that I would run the steps, for I did not want to be late. Out of the stairway door, I popped like a gopher and scurried across the uneven tile floor until I reached the ward wherein Luther lay. I rested my head against the wall for a moment, took a deep breath to clear my head, excused myself from the presence of a paraplegic, and entered the doorway, only to find that bed number 3 was empty. Empty in that it was lifeless, it was sterile. The clean bed linen covered the bed where Luther had laid for more than 6 weeks. There was not a sign left that he had ever been there. At the nurse's desk, I asked, already knowing the answer to my question of where was Luther, he was in the basement, the place they put all the dead bodies until they were collected. I was too late to make the visit I should have made years before. As I passed effortlessly through the sliding doors of the hospital, the sun had managed to pry a wedge through the cloud which only moments earlier had decided to dispense a few drops of rain. The light caught a teardrop of rain about to fall from a newly opened tulip just right, so that it took hold of my eye and I watched the tear fall to the rich black soil. And I thought, what on earth is this? The answer was clear. What on earth was the seed of God? A seed cast not once, but again and again, seeds thrown and cast through my mouth. And by my presence, all the while I thought I was there for myself, God had other plans. On earth was the seed of Jesus in the body of old Luther Mundahl, the one I thought to be nothing more than a rock. And yet you ask, what did he yield? I can't say. That is a mystery always to remain hidden. Did Luther become the rich black soil to hold the teardrops of rain? Again, a mystery hidden from my eyes. But what I do know, and what is not a mystery, what is not hidden from my eyes, is what on earth God is up to. You see, God is planting. God is casting and throwing the seeds of Christ wherever he so chooses, on what I would call wasteland, fruitless, barren land, God sows the seed of his Son. And there he covers the rocks and the reed and the weeds with the blood of his own Son, Jesus Christ. God is planting on earth his grace. The death and the resurrection of Jesus in people. In people like old Luther Mundell and in people like you. Thank you. It is time, 10 o'clock, our time has passed. I thank you for this past week, your participation, and your ears to listen. Thank you.